guilty of all who felt they would not have acted like myself. The following day, Gilliatt wrote me a note, in which he gave me an account of the success of my piece, and of the great fancy which the king himself had conceived for it. All day long, he informed me, his majesty is continually singing, with the most execrable voice in his kingdom, and utterly out of tune, J'ai perdu mon serviteur, j'ai perdu tout mon bonheur. He added that in a fortnight a second performance of the Devin was to be given, which would establish in the eyes of all the public the complete success of the first. 2 days later, as I was going to supper at Madame d'Epinay's, about 9 o'clock in the evening, a coach passed me at the door. Someone inside made a sign to me to get in. I did so. The person was Diderot. He spoke to me about the pension more warmly than I should have expected a philosopher to speak on such a subject. He did not regard my unwillingness to be presented to the king as an offence, but he considered my indifference about the pension as a terrible crime. He said to me that even if I was disinterested on my own account, I had no right to be so in regard to Madame Levasseur and her daughter, that I owed it to them to neglect no honourable means within my reach of providing for their support. And as, after all, it could not be said that I had refused this pension, he insisted that, since there appeared a disposition to bestow it upon me, I ought to ask for it and obtain it, at any cost. Although I felt touched by his zeal, I was unable to approve of his principles, and we had a lively discussion on the subject, the first which had ever occurred between us. All our subsequent disputes were of the same kind, he dictating to me what he maintained I ought to do, while I as firmly refused, because I did not believe it was my duty. It was late when we separated. I wanted to take him with me to supper at Madame d'Epinay's, but he would not go. And in spite of the efforts which the desire of bringing together those whom I regarded with affection caused me to make from time to time, to induce him to visit her, I even went so far as to take her to his door, which he refused to open to us. He always declined to see her, and never spoke of her except with great contempt. It was only after my disagreement with both that they became intimate, and that he began to speak of her with respect. From that time Diderot and Grimm seemed to make it their object to set the gouverneurs against me. This is a half-contemptuous term for the women-folk. By giving them to understand that if they were not better off, it was entirely my fault, and that they would never do any good with me. They tried to induce them to leave me, and promised them, through Madame d'Epinay's interest, a license to sell salt, or a tobacconist's shop, and I know not what besides. They even tried to drag Duclos and Holbach into their alliance, but the former persistently refused to join them. At the time, I had some notion of their intrigues, but I only learned them clearly a long time afterwards, and I often had reason to lament the blind and indiscreet zeal of my friends, who, endeavouring to reduce me, in mine ill health, to a state of most melancholy isolation, imagined that they were doing their utmost to make me happy, by the very means which, beyond all others, were most adapted to make me utterly miserable. 1753. In the following Carnival, the Devin was played at Paris, and during the interval I had time to compose the overture and divertissement. The latter, as it was designed and engraved, was intended to keep up a sustained and connected action from one end of the piece to the other, which, in my judgment, gave opportunities for very agreeable tableaux. But when I proposed this idea at the opera, I was not even listened to, and I was obliged to patch together songs and dances in the ordinary manner. The result was that the divertissement, although full of charming ideas, which certainly did not damage the effect of the scenes, only enjoyed a very moderate success. I struck out Gilliatt's recitative and restored my own in its original form, as it is engraved. And this recitative, somewhat Frenchified, I confess, that is to say, drawled out by the actors, far from offending anyone, was as successful as the music, and was considered, even by the people, equally well composed. I dedicated my piece to Monsieur Duclos, who had taken it under his protection, and declared that this should be my only dedication. However, I wrote a second with his consent. But he must have thought himself still more honoured by the exception than if I'd written none at all. I could relate a number of anecdotes about this piece, but more important matters which I must mention do not allow me time to dwell upon them here. I may, perhaps, on a future occasion return to them in a supplement. One, however, I must mention, which may have reference to all that follows. I was one day looking over the Baron Dolbach's music in his study. After I had looked through a number of pieces of different kinds, he showed me a collection of pieces for the piano and said, "These were written especially for me. They are very tasteful and well suited for singing. No one is acquainted with them or shall ever see them except myself. You ought to select one and introduce it into your divertissement." As I already had in my mind far more subjects for airs and symphonies than I could ever make use of, I cared very little about this. However, he pressed me so earnestly that, to oblige him, I selected a shepherd's song, which I abridged and altered into a trio, for the entry of Colette's companions. Some months afterwards, while the Devin was still running, on going into Grimm's rooms, I found a number of people round his piano, from which he hastily got up on my arrival. Looking mechanically at his music-stand, I saw the identical collection of Baron Dolbach open exactly at the piece which he had pressed me to take, while assuring me that it should never leave his hands. Some time afterwards I saw the same collection open on Monsieur d'Epinay's piano, one day when there was some music at his house. Neither Grimm nor anyone else ever spoke to me about this air, and I should have said nothing about it myself, if it had not been rumoured, some time afterwards, that I was not the author of the Devin du Village. As I was never a great instrumentalist, I am convinced that had it not been for my Dictionary of Music, it would at last have been said that I knew nothing about the subject. I could not foresee that, in spite of the dictionary, this would really be said of me. Some time before the Devin du Village was performed, some Italian comedians had arrived in Paris and were ordered to play at the opera. The effect which they were destined to produce could not be foreseen. Although they were detestable, and the orchestra, at that time very ill-trained, mutilated to its heart's content the pieces which they performed, they nevertheless fatally injured the French opera. The comparison of the two kinds of music, heard the same day at the same theatre, opened the French ears. None of them could endure their drawling music after the lively and pronounced accentuation of the Italian. As soon as the comedians had finished, everyone left the house. It was found necessary to change the order of representation and to put off the performance of the comedians to the last. Aigle, Pygmalion, and Le Sylphe were played. Nothing held its ground. The Devin du Village alone could bear comparison, and was listened to with pleasure, even after the Serva Padrona. When I composed my interlude, I had my head full of these pieces, and borrowed my ideas from them. But I was far from suspecting that my piece would be criticised by the side of them. If I'd been a plagiarist, how many thefts would then have been detected, and how eagerly would they have been pointed out? But nothing of the kind was discovered. All attempts to find in my music the slightest reminiscence of any other were in vain, and all my songs, when compared with the supposed originals, were found to be as new as the character of the music which I had created. If Mondonville or Rameau had been forced to submit to such a test, they would not have escaped without being torn to shreds. The comedians gained some very ardent support for Italian music. Paris was divided into two parties, more violently opposed than if it had been a matter of religion or of an affair of state. One, the more numerous and influential, composed of the great, the wealthy, and the ladies, supported the French music. The other, more lively, more proud, and more enthusiastic, was composed of real connoisseurs, persons of talent, and men of genius. This little group assembled at the opera under the Queen's box. The other party filled the rest of the pit and house, but its chief meeting place was under the King's box. This was the origin of these celebrated party names, King's Corner and Queen's Corner. The dispute, as it became more animated, gave rise to several brochures. If the King's Corner attempted to be witty, it was ridiculed by the Petit Prophet. If it attempted to argue, it was crushed by the Lettres sur la musique française. These two little pamphlets, by Grimm and myself respectively, are all that have survived the quarrel. All the rest are already forgotten. But the Petit Prophet, which in spite of my denial was for a long time attributed to me, was taken as a joke, and did not bring the least annoyance upon its author. Whereas the Lettres sur la musique was taken seriously, and roused against me the whole nation, which considered itself insulted in its music. A description of the incredible effect of this brochure would be worthy of the pen of Tacitus. It was the time of the great quarrel between Parliament and clergy. The Parliament had just been banished, the ferment was at its height. Everything pointed to an approaching outburst. From the moment the brochure appeared, all other quarrels were at once forgotten. Nothing was thought of except the perilous condition of French music. And the only outburst was against myself. It was such that the nation has never quite recovered from it. At court, the only doubt was whether the Bastille or exile should be the punishment. And the royal warrant of arrest would have been drawn up had not Monsieur de Voyer shown the ridiculous aspect of the affair. Anyone who sees it stated that this brochure possibly prevented a revolution in the state will believe that he is dreaming. It is, however, an actual truth which all Paris can still attest, since it is at the present day no more than 15 years since this singular incident took place. Although my liberty was not attacked, I was unsparingly insulted, and even my life was in danger. The opera orchestra entered into an honourable conspiracy to assassinate me when I left the theatre. Being informed of this, I only attended the opera more frequently than before, and it was not until a long time afterwards that I learned that Monsieur Ancelet, an officer in the Musketeers, who was kindly disposed towards me, had prevented the plot from being carried out, by causing me to be protected, unknown to myself, when I left the theatre. The city had recently taken over the management of the opera. The first exploit of the Prévôt des Marchands was to deprive me of my free pass, in the most uncivil manner possible, by publicly refusing me admission when I presented myself, so that I was obliged to take a ticket for the amphitheatre to avoid the mortification of going back. The injustice was the more outrageous, as the only recompense I had stipulated for, when I gave up my rights in the piece, was a free pass for life. For, although this was a privilege which all authors enjoyed, and I had thus a double claim to it, I nevertheless expressly stipulated for it in Monsieur Duclos' presence. It is true that 50 louis were sent to me through the treasurer of the opera by way of honorarium, which I had not asked for. But besides that, these 50 louis were not even equal to the amount which was due to me according to the regulations. This payment had nothing to do with the right of admission, which had been formally stipulated for, and which was entirely independent of it. In this behaviour there was such a combination of injustice and brutality that the public, although at the height of its animosity against me, was nevertheless unanimously disgusted at it, and many, who had insulted me on the previous evening, cried out loudly on the following day in the house that it was a shame to deprive an author in this manner of his right of admission, which he had well deserved, and which he was even entitled to claim for 2 persons. So true is the Italian proverb, "Ognun ama la giustizia in casa d'altrui." Under these circumstances, I had only one course to take, to demand the return of my work, since the recompense agreed upon was withheld. I wrote to that effect to Monsieur d'Argenson, who had control of the opera, adding to my letter an unanswerable memorandum. Letter and memorandum both remained unanswered, and produced no effect. This unjust man's silence wounded me deeply, and did not tend to increase the very moderate opinion which I had always entertained of his character and ability. Thus the opera kept my peace, and defrauded me of the recompense for which I had surrendered my rights in it. Between the weak and the strong, this would be called robbery. Between the strong and the weak, it is simply called the appropriation of what belongs to one's neighbour. As for the pecuniary profits of this work, although it did not bring me in a quarter of what it would have brought in the hands of another, they were, nevertheless, large enough to enable me to live upon them for several years, and to make up for the continued ill success of my copying. I received 100 louis from the king, 50 from Madame de Pompadour for the performance at Bellevue, at which she herself took the part of Colin, 50 from the opera, and 500 francs from Pissot for the engraving. So that this interlude, which cost me no more than 5 or 6 weeks' work, in spite of my ill luck and stupidity, brought me in almost as much as my Emile, on which I spent 20 years of meditation and 3 years of labour. But I paid dearly for the pecuniary ease which this piece procured me, by the endless annoyance which it brought upon me. It was the germ of the secret jealousies, which did not break out until long afterwards. From the time of its success, I no longer found in Grimm, Diderot, or with few exceptions, in any of the men of letters with whom I was acquainted. The cordiality, the frankness, or pleasure in my society, which I believed I had hitherto found in them. As soon as I appeared at the Baron's, the conversation ceased to be general. Those present collected in small groups and whispered together, so that I was left alone, without knowing whom to speak to. For a long time I endured this mortifying neglect, and, finding that Madame d'Holbach, who was gentle and amiable, always received me kindly, I put up with her husband's rudeness as long as it was possible. One day, however, he attacked me without reason or excuse, and with such brutality, in the presence of Diderot, who never said a word, and of Margency, who has often told me since then that he admired the gentleness and moderation of my answers, that at last, driven away by this unworthy treatment, I left his house, resolved never to enter it again. However, this did not prevent me from always speaking respectfully of himself and his house, while he never expressed himself in regard to me in other than most insulting and contemptuous terms. He never spoke of me except as the little cuistre, corresponding somewhat to a college servitor, without, however, being able to point to a single wrong of any kind which I had ever done to him, or anyone in whom he took an interest. This was the manner in which he fulfilled my predictions and my fears. As for myself, I believe that my friends would have forgiven me for writing books, even excellent books, because such a reputation was attainable by themselves. But they were unable to forgive me for having composed an opera, or for its brilliant success, because not one of them was capable of following the same career, or aspiring to the same honour. Duclos alone, superior to such jealousy, seemed to become even more attached to me. He introduced me to Mademoiselle Quinault, by whom I was treated with as much attention, politeness, and friendliness as I had found wanting at the Baron's house. While the Devin was being played at the opera, its author was also discussed at the Comédie Française, but somewhat less favourably. Having vainly attempted, during 7 or 8 years, to get my Narcisse performed at the Italian opera, I became disgusted with this theatre, since the actors performed so badly in French pieces. And I should have been glad to get my piece accepted at the Comédie Française rather than at the Italian opera. I mentioned my wish to Lanoux, the comedian, whose acquaintance I had made, and who, as is well known, was an author and an accomplished man. He was pleased with Narcisse, and undertook to get it performed anonymously. Meanwhile, he procured me a pass, which was a great pleasure to me, since I have always preferred the Théâtre Français to the other two. The piece was received with applause, and performed without the author's name being given. But I have reason to believe that the actors, and many others, were not ignorant who it was. Mesdemoiselles Gossin and Gonval played the love parts, and although, in my opinion, the performance showed a lack of intelligence generally, it could not be called absolutely bad. However, I was surprised and touched by the indulgence of the public, who had the patience to listen quietly from beginning to end, and even to allow it to be performed a second time without exhibiting the least signs of impatience. As for myself, I was so bored with the first that I could not sit out to the end. I left the theatre and went into the Café de Procope, where I found Boissy and others, who had probably been as much bored as myself. There I cried, Peccavi, and humbly or proudly confessed myself the author of the piece, and spoke of it as everyone thought of it. This public confession of the authorship of a piece which had failed was much admired, and caused me little pain. I even found a certain satisfaction to my amour propre in the courage with which I had made it. And I believe that on this occasion there was more pride in speaking than there would have been false shame in keeping silence. However, as there was no doubt that the piece, although spoilt at the performance, would bear reading, I had it printed, and in the preface, which is one of my best productions, I began to express my principles a little more freely than I had hitherto done. I soon had an opportunity to disclose them unreservedly in a work of greater importance, for it was, I think, in this year, 1753, that The Origin of Inequality Amongst Mankind appeared as the subject proposed for discussion by the Academy of Dijon. Struck by this great question, I felt surprised that this Academy had ventured to propose it. But since it had had the courage to do so, I thought I might have the courage to discuss it, and undertook the task. In order to consider this great subject at my ease, I went to Saint-Germain on a 7 or 8 days' journey, with Thérèse, our hostess, who was a good sort of woman, and one of her friends. I count this trip as one of the most agreeable in my life. It was very fine weather. The good women took all the trouble and expense upon themselves. Thérèse amused herself with them, while I, relieved from all anxiety, joined them at mealtimes, and diverted myself without having anything to trouble me. The remainder of the day I buried myself in the forest, where I sought and found the picture of those primitive times, of which I boldly sketched the history. I demolished the pitiful lies of mankind. I dared to expose their nature in all its nakedness, to follow the progress of time and of the things which have disfigured this nature. And, comparing the man, as man has made him, with the natural man, I showed him, in his pretended perfection, the true source of his misery. My soul, uplifted by these sublime considerations, ascended to the divinity, and seeing my fellow creatures following blindly the path of their prejudices, their errors, their misfortunes, and their crimes, I cried aloud to them with a feeble voice which they could not hear. Fools who continually complain of nature, learn that you bring all your misfortunes upon yourselves. The result of these meditations was the Essay on Inequality, a work which was more to Diderot's taste than any of my other writings. He gave most useful advice concerning it. But it only found few readers in Europe who understood it, and none of the latter ever chose to speak of it. At the time when I wrote these words, I had no suspicion of Diderot's and Grimm's great conspiracy. Otherwise, I should easily have seen how the former abused my confidence in order to give my writings the harsh tone and air of gloominess which ceased to be found in them when he no longer guided me. The description of the philosopher who, in the course of an argument, stops up his ears in order to harden himself against the complaints of a man in distress, is in his style, and he had supplied me with several others, even still stronger, which I could never bring myself to use. But, as I attributed to his confinement in the donjon of Vincennes this melancholy tinge, which may be found again in considerable proportions in his Clerval, it never occurred to me to suspect any evil intention. It was written as a prize competition. I sent it, feeling certain beforehand that it would be unsuccessful, as I knew well that the prizes of academies were not intended for works of the kind. This excursion and occupation were beneficial to my health and temper. Several years before, tortured by my retention of urine, I had put myself unreservedly into the physician's hands, and they, without alleviating my sufferings, had exhausted my strength and undermined my constitution. After my return from Saint-Germain, I found myself stronger and better. I took the hint and determined to recover or die without the assistance of physicians or drugs. I said goodbye to them forever and began to live without any fixed rules, remaining quiet when I could not walk, and walking as soon as I was strong enough to do so. Life in Paris amongst pretentious people was little to my taste. The cabals of men of letters, their shameful quarrels, their lack of candour as exhibited in their books, the haughty airs they gave themselves in society, were all so hateful to me and so antipathetic. I found so little gentleness, open-heartedness, and frankness, even in the society of my friends, that, disgusted with this tumultuous life, I became to long earnestly for residence in the country, and as I saw no prospect of my profession allowing me to settle there, I hastened to spend in it at least the few hours which I had to spare. For several months, at first after dinner, I used to go for a walk by myself in the Bois de Boulogne, to think over subjects for future works, and did not return till nightfall. 1754 to 1756. Gaufrecourt, with whom I was at the time extremely intimate, found himself obliged to make a journey to Geneva on business, and proposed to me to accompany him. I consented. As I was not well enough to be able to dispense with the care of the gouverneurs, it was decided that she should go with us, and that her mother should look after the house. Having made all our arrangements, we all three set out together on the 1st of June, 1754. I must mention this journey as the period of the first experience, which, in the course of a life of 42 years, gave a shock to the confidence of my naturally unsuspicious disposition, to which I had always abandoned myself without reserve and without inconvenience. We had a hired carriage, which conveyed us by very short daily stages, without changing horses. I often got down and walked. We had scarcely performed half the journey when Thérèse showed the greatest repugnance to remaining alone in the carriage with Gaufrecourt, and when, in spite of her entreaties, I wanted to get down, she did the same, and walked with me. For some time I scolded her for this whim, and even opposed it so strongly, that she felt obliged to declare the reason for her conduct. I thought that I was dreaming. I fell from the clouds when I heard that my friend de Gaufrecourt, more than 60 years old, gouty, impotent, and worn out by a life of pleasure and dissipation, had been doing his utmost, since we had started, to corrupt a person who was no longer young or beautiful, and who belonged to his friend, and that by the lowest and most disgraceful means, even going so far as to offer her money, and attempting to excite her passions by reading a disgusting book to her, and showing her the disgraceful pictures of which it was full. Thérèse, in a fit of indignation, once threw his villainous book out of the carriage, and she told me that the very first day, when I had gone to bed before supper, with a very violent headache, he had employed all the time, during which he was alone with her, in attempts and actions more worthy of a satyr or he-goat than of an honourable man, to whom I had confided myself and my companion. What a surprise! What an entirely new cause of grief for me! I, who had until then believed that friendship was inseparable from all the amiable and noble sentiments which constitute all its charm, for the first time in my life found myself compelled to couple it with contempt, and to withdraw my confidence and esteem from a man whom I loved, and by whom I believed myself to be loved. The wretch concealed his disgraceful conduct from me, and to avoid exposing Thérèse I found myself compelled to conceal my contempt from him, and to keep hidden, in the bottom of my heart, feelings which he was never to know. Sweet and holy illusion of friendship! Gaufrecourt was the first to lift thy veil before my eyes. How many cruel hands since then have prevented it from covering thy face again! At Lyon, I left Gauffecourt to take the road through Savoy, as I could not bring myself to be so near Mamma again without seeing her once more. I saw her again. My God, in what a condition! How low had she fallen! What was left of her former virtue? Could it be the same Madame de Varens, once so brilliant, to whom Monsieur Panvert, the curé, had sent me? How my heart was torn! The only resource I could see for her was that she should leave the country. I reiterated, earnestly but in vain, the entreaties which I had several times addressed to her in my letters, begging her to come and live quietly with me, and let me devote my life and Thérèse's to make her own happy. Clinging to her pension, from which, although it was regularly paid, she had for a long time drawn nothing, she refused to listen to me. I gave her a small portion of my money, much less than I ought to have given, much less than I should have given her if I had not felt certain that she would not have spent a sou upon herself. During my stay in Geneva, she took a journey to Chablais and came to see me at Grange Canal. She had no money to continue her journey. I had not as much with me as she wanted, and sent it to her by Thérèse an hour later. Poor Mamma! Let me mention one more proof of her goodness of heart. Her sole remaining jewel was a little ring. She took it from her finger and placed it upon that of Thérèse, who immediately replaced it, at the same time kissing and bathing in her tears that noble hand. Ah, then would have been the moment to pay my debt. I ought to have left all and followed her, to have never left her until her last hour, to have shared her lot, whatever it might have been. I did nothing of the kind. Occupied with another attachment, I felt the tie which bound us loosened, for want of any hope of being able to make it of any use to her. I wept over her, but did not follow her. Of all the stings of conscience that I've ever felt, this was the sharpest and most lasting. My conduct deserved the terrible punishment, which since then has never ceased to overwhelm me. I hope it may have atoned for my ingratitude, which, indeed, showed itself in my conduct, but has wounded my heart too deeply for it ever to have been the heart of an ungrateful man. Before I left Paris, I had sketched the dedication of my essay on inequality. I finished it at Chambéry, and dated it from that place, thinking it better, in order to avoid all unpleasantness, not to date it either from France or Geneva. On my arrival in this city, I gave myself up to the republican enthusiasm which had led me there. This enthusiasm was increased by the reception I met with. Fêted and made much of by all classes, I abandoned myself entirely to patriotic zeal, and, ashamed of being excluded from my rights as a citizen by the profession of a religion different from that of my father's, I resolved publicly to return to the latter, as the gospel was the same for every Christian, and as the essential part of the doctrine only differed in the attempts of different people to explain what they were unable to understand. I said to myself that in each country it was the right of the sovereign alone to define the manner of worship and to settle the unintelligible dogma, and that it was consequently the duty of every good citizen to accept the dogma and to follow the manner of worship prescribed by the law. Constant association with the encyclopedists, far from shaking my faith, had strengthened it, in consequence of my natural aversion to quarrels and schism. The study of man and the universe had everywhere shown me the final causes and the intelligence which directed them. The reading of the Bible, especially the Gospels, to which I had for several years devoted myself, had taught me to despise the low and foolish interpretations given to the teaching of Jesus Christ by persons utterly unworthy of understanding it. In a word, philosophy, while firmly attaching me to what was essential in religion, had released me from the petty and rubbishy forms with which it has been obscured. Believing that, for an intelligent man, there could not be two ways of being a Christian, I also believed that all religious form and discipline in each country came under the jurisdiction of the law. from this reasonable, social, and pacific principle, which has brought upon me such cruel persecutions, it followed that if I desired to become a citizen, I ought to be a Protestant, and to return to the religion of my country. I accordingly determined to do so. I even submitted to the instructions of the pastor of the parish in which I was staying, which was outside the city. I only desired not to be obliged to appear before the consistory. However, the ecclesiastical law was definite in regard to this. But they were kind enough to make an exemption in my favour, and a commission of 5 or 6 members was appointed to receive my profession of faith in private. Unfortunately, Pertriot, the minister, a mild and amiable man, with whom I was on friendly terms, took it into his head to tell me that they were delighted at the idea of hearing me speak in this little assembly. The expectation of this so alarmed me that after having studied night and day for 3 weeks a little speech which I had prepared, I became so confused at the moment when I had to deliver it that I was unable to utter a single word of it, and at this meeting I behaved like the most stupid schoolboy. The members of the commission spoke for me. I answered yes and no, like a fool. After which I was admitted to the communion and reinstated in my rights as a citizen. I was enrolled as such in the list of the civic guards, who are paid by the citizens and full burgesses only, and I attended an extraordinary general council to receive the oath from the syndic. Syndic was the head of a corporation. Moussa. I was so touched by the kindness shown to me on this occasion by the council and consistory, and by the courteous and polite behaviour of all the magistrates, ministers, and citizens, that, persuaded by the persistent entreaties of the excellent Deluc, and influenced still more by my own inclinations, I decided only to return to Paris to break up my establishment, arrange my little business matters, find a situation for Madame Levasseur and her husband, or provide for their wants, and then to return with Thérèse and settle at Geneva for the rest of my life. This resolution once taken, I suspended all serious occupations in order to enjoy myself with my friends, until it was time to set out for Paris. Of all my amusements, that which pleased me most was rowing round the lake with Deluc, his daughter-in-law, his 2 sons, and my Thérèse. We spent 7 days in this excursion, in the most beautiful weather. I preserved the liveliest recollection of the spots which had delighted me at the other end of the lake, and which I described some years later in the Nouvelle Héloïse. The principal connections which I formed at Geneva, besides the Delucs whom I've mentioned, were the young minister, Verne, whose acquaintance I had already made in Paris, and of whom I had a better opinion than he afterwards justified. Monsieur Pertriot, at that time a country pastor, now professor of belles lettres, whose pleasant and agreeable society I shall ever regret, although he has since thought it the proper thing to break off the acquaintance. Monsieur Jalabert, professor of physics, since then counsellor and syndic, to whom I read my Essay on Inequality, omitting the dedication, with which he appeared delighted. Professor Lulin, with whom I kept up a correspondence up to the time of his death, and who even commissioned me to purchase some books for the library. Professor Vernet, who turned his back upon me, like the rest of the world, after I had shown him proofs of attachment and friendship, which ought to have touched him, if a theologian could be touched by anything. Chapuis, clerk and successor to Gaufcourt, whom he desired to supplant, and who was soon afterwards supplanted himself. Marcel de Mézières, an old friend of my father, who had also shown himself mine, but who, after having formerly deserved well of his country, became a dramatic author and candidate for the 200, changed his opinions and made himself ridiculous before his death. But the acquaintance from whom I hoped most was Moultou, a young man whose talents and ardent spirit aroused the greatest expectations. I've always felt an affection for him, although his conduct towards myself has often been suspicious, and he is on intimate terms with my bitterest enemies, But notwithstanding all this, I cannot prevent myself from looking upon him as one day destined to become the defender of my memory, and the avenger of his friend. In the midst of these amusements, I neither lost the taste for my solitary walks, nor discontinued them. I frequently took long rambles on the shores of the lake, during which my brain, accustomed to work, did not remain idle. I worked up the outline of my Institution Politique, of which I shall have to speak presently. I projected a Histoire du Valais, a tragedy in prose, the subject of which was nothing less than Lucretia, by which I hoped to crush the scoffers, although I ventured to introduce this unfortunate woman on the stage again at a time when she was no longer possible at any French theatre. I also tried my hand at Tacitus, and made a translation of the first book of the histories, which will be found amongst my papers. After 4 months' stay at Geneva, I returned to Paris in October, avoiding Lyon, so as not to meet Gauffecourt. As I did not intend to return to Geneva until the following spring, I resumed, during the winter, my usual habits and occupations, the chief of which was the correction of the proofs of my Discourse on Inequality, which was being published in Holland by Ray, whose acquaintance I had recently made at Geneva. As this work was dedicated to the Republic, and this dedication might be displeasing to the Council, I waited to see the effect it produced at Geneva before I returned there. The result was not favourable to me, and this dedication, which had been dictated solely by the purest patriotism, made enemies for me in the Council, and brought upon me the jealousy of some of the citizens. Monsieur Chouet, at that time chief syndic, wrote me a polite but cold letter, which will be found in my collection, Packet A, number 3. From private individuals, amongst others De Luc and Jalabert, I received a few compliments, and that was all. I did not find that a single Genevese really thanked me for the hearty zeal which was to be found in the work. This indifference shocked all those who observed it. I remember that one day at Clichy, when I was dining with Madame Dupin, in company with Cromelin, Minister of the Republic, and Monsieur de Mayrin, the latter openly declared that the Council owed me a reward and public honours for this work, and that it would disgrace itself if it failed to do its duty. Cromelin, who was a dark and vulgarly spiteful little man, did not venture to make any answer in my presence, but he made a frightful grimace, which caused Madame Dupin to smile. The only advantage, besides the satisfaction it afforded my heart, which I obtained from this work, was the title of Citizen, which was bestowed upon me by my friends, and afterwards by the public, which I afterwards lost from having deserved it too well. However, this ill success would not have kept me from carrying out my intention of retiring to Geneva, had not motives which had greater influence over my heart contributed to this result. Monsieur d'Epinay, being desirous of adding a wing which was wanting to the Chateau of La Chevrette, went to extraordinary expense to finish it. One day, having gone, in company with Madame d'Epinay, to see the works, we continued our walk a quarter of a league further, as far as the reservoir of the waters of the park, which adjoined the forest of Montmorency, where there was a pretty kitchen garden, attached to which was a small and very dilapidated cottage called the Ermitage. This solitary and agreeable spot had struck my attention when I saw it for the first time, before my journey to Geneva. In my transport, I let fall the exclamation, "Ah, madam, what a delightful place to live in! Here is a refuge ready-made for me." Madame d'Epinay did not take much notice of my words at the time, but on this second visit I was quite surprised to find, in place of the old ruins, a little house almost entirely new, very nicely arranged, and very habitable for a small establishment of 3 persons. Madame d'Epinay had had the work carried out quietly, and at very trifling expense, by taking some materials and some of the workmen from the chateau. When she saw my surprise, she said, "There, Mr. Bear, there is your asylum. You chose it. Friendship offers it to you. I hope that it will put an end to your cruel idea of separating from me. I do not believe that I have ever felt more deeply or more delightfully touched. I bathed with my tears the beneficent hand of my friend, and if I was not vanquished from that moment, I was sorely shaken in my resolution. Madame d'Épinay, who was unwilling to be beaten, became so pressing, employed so many different means, and so many persons in order to get over me, even enlisting Madame Levasseur and her daughter in her service, that she finally triumphed over my resolutions. Abandoning the idea of settling in my native country, I decided, and promised, to live in the Hermitage. And while the building was getting dry, she undertook to see after the furniture, so that all was ready for occupation the following spring. One thing which greatly contributed to confirm my resolution was the fact that Voltaire had settled in the neighbourhood of Geneva. I knew that this man would cause a revolution there, that I should find again in my own country the tone, the airs, and the manners which drove me from Paris, that I should have to maintain a perpetual struggle, and that no other choice would be left to me except to behave either as an insufferable pedant or as a coward and a bad citizen. The letter which Voltaire wrote to me about my last work caused me to hint at my apprehensions in my reply. The effect which it produced confirmed them. From that moment I looked upon Geneva as lost, and I was not mistaken. I ought perhaps to have defied the storm, if I had felt that I was capable of doing so. But what could I, timid and a poor speaker, have done unaided against one who was so arrogant, wealthy, supported by the credit of the great, brilliantly eloquent, and already the idol of the women and young men? I was afraid of exposing my courage uselessly to danger. I only listened to the voice of my naturally peaceable disposition, and my love of tranquillity, which, if it deceived me then, still deceives me at the present day, in this particular. By retiring to Geneva, I should have spared myself great misfortunes, but I doubt whether, with all my ardent and patriotic zeal, I should have done anything great or serviceable to my country. Tronchin, who, nearly about the same time, settled at Geneva, came to Paris some time afterwards to play the quack, and brought away some of its treasures. On his arrival he came to see me with the Chevalier de Jeancourt. Madame d'Épinay was very anxious to consult him privately, but it was difficult to get through the crowd. She had recourse to me, and I induced him to go and see her. Thus, under my auspices, they commenced a connection, which later they strengthened at my expense. Such has ever been my lot. No sooner have I brought together separate friends of my own than they infallibly combined against me. Although, in the conspiracy which the Tronchins from that time entered into, to reduce their country to a state of servitude, they must all have felt a mortal hatred towards me. The doctor for a long time continued to show me proofs of his good will. He even wrote to me after his return to Geneva, offering me the post of honorary librarian. But my mind was made up, and this offer did not shake my resolution. At this time I returned to Monsieur d'Holbach. The reason for my visit was the death of his wife, which had taken place during my stay at Geneva. Madame Francois had also died during the same interval. Diderot, when informing me of the death of Madame d'Holbach, spoke of the husband's deep affliction. His grief touched my heart, and I myself regretted this amiable woman. I wrote to Monsieur d'Holbach a letter of condolence. The sad event made me forget all his injustice. And when I returned from Geneva, and he himself came back from a tour through France, which he had made in company with Grimm and some other friends, to divert his thoughts from his sorrow, I went to visit him, and continued to do so until my departure for the Hermitage. When it became known in his circle that Madame d'Épinay, with whom he was not yet acquainted, was preparing a dwelling-place for me, sarcasms fell upon me thick as hail. It was said that, unable to live without the flattery and amusements of the city, I could not endure to remain even a fortnight in solitude. Conscious of my real feelings, I let them say what they pleased and went my way. Nevertheless, Monsieur d'Holbach helped me to find a place for good old Levasseur, who was over 80 years of age. Here is an instance of the tricks which my memory plays me. Long after writing this, I have just learnt, while talking with my wife about her good old father, that it was not Monsieur d'Holbach, but Monsieur de Chenonceau, at that time one of the committee of the Hôtel Dieu, who procured him the place. I had so completely forgotten him, and had so lively a recollection of Monsieur d'Holbach, that I could have sworn that it had been he. The Hôtel Dieu is the oldest hospital in Paris. And Madame Levasseur, feeling the burden too heavy for her, continually begged me to relieve her of it. He was put into a poorhouse, where his great age and his grief at finding himself separated from his family brought him to the grave almost as soon as he was admitted. His wife and children felt but little regret for him, but Thérèse, who loved him fondly, has never consoled herself for his loss, and has never forgiven herself for allowing him, when so near his end, to finish his days at a distance from her. About the same time I received a visit, which I little expected, although from an old acquaintance. I speak of my friend Venture, who surprised me one fine morning, when he was the last person I was thinking of. He had a companion with him. How changed he appeared to be! Instead of his former graceful manners, I only found in him a general air of dissipation, which prevented me from opening my heart to him. Either my eyes were no longer the same, or debauchery had stupefied his intellect, or else all his early brilliancy had depended upon the brilliancy of youth, which he no longer possessed. I treated him almost with indifference, and we parted rather coolly. But after he had left, the remembrance of our former intimacy so vividly recalled the recollections of my own youth, so delightfully and so completely devoted to the angelic woman who was now no less changed than himself, the little incidents of that happy time, the romantic day's journey to Thun, spent so innocently and delightfully in the company of the two charming girls, whose only favour had been a kiss on the hand, which, nevertheless, had left behind such lively, touching, and lasting regret. All the delightful transports of a young heart, which I had then felt in all their force, and which I thought were gone for ever, all these tender reminiscences made me weep for my past youth and its delights, henceforth lost for me. Ah, how I should have wept over their tardy and melancholy return, if I had foreseen the sorrow they were to cost me. Before I left Paris, during the winter which preceded my retirement, I enjoyed a pleasure quite after my own heart, which I tasted in all its purity. Palissot, a member of the Academy of Nancy, who was known for some plays which he had written, had just had one performed at Lunéville before the King of Poland. He evidently hoped to gain favour by introducing, in this piece, a man who had ventured to cross pens with the king. Stanislaus, who was a generous man and not fond of satire, was indignant that anyone should venture to introduce personalities in his presence. Monsieur le Comte de Tressan wrote, by this prince's orders, to D'Alembert and myself, to inform me that it was His Majesty's intention to procure the expulsion of Palissot from the Academy. In reply, I earnestly entreated Monsieur de Tressan to intercede with the king in Palissot's favour. He was pardoned, and Monsieur de Tressan, when informing me of it in the king's name, added that the incident would be inserted in the records of the Academy. I replied that this would rather be inflicting a perpetual punishment than granting a pardon. At last, by dint of entreaties, I succeeded in obtaining a promise that the whole affair should be kept out of the records, and that no trace of it should appear in public. The promise was accompanied, both on the part of the king and of Monsieur de Tressan, by protestations of esteem and regard, which flattered me exceedingly. And I felt on this occasion that the esteem of those who are so worthy of it themselves produce in the soul a feeling far sweeter and nobler than that of vanity. I have inserted in my collection the letters of Monsieur de Tressan, together with my replies. The originals will be found in Bundle A, numbers 9, 10, and 11. I quite feel that if these memoirs ever see the light, I am here perpetuating the memory of an incident, all traces of which I desired to efface. But I have handed down many other incidents to posterity with equal reluctance. The great object of my undertaking, which is ever before my eyes, the indispensable duty of carrying it out in its fullest extent, will not permit me to be turned aside for my purpose by unimportant considerations, which would divert me from my object. In my singular and unique situation, I owe too much to truth to owe anything further to anyone else. In order to know me well, one must know me in all my aspects, both good and bad. My confessions are necessarily connected with those of many others. I make both with equal frankness in all that relates to myself, as I do not think that I am bound to treat anyone else with greater consideration than myself, although I should certainly like to do so. I desire to be always just and truthful, to say as much good of others as I can, only to speak evil when it concerns myself, and when I am compelled to do so. Who, in the position in which I have been placed by the world, has the right to demand more from me? My confessions are not written to appear during my lifetime, or that of the persons concerned in them. If I were the master of my own destiny, and of that of this work, it should not see the light until long after my death and their own. But the efforts, which the dread of truth causes my powerful oppressors to make, in order to efface all traces of it, force me to do all that the most scrupulous fairness and the strictest sense of justice allow me, in order to preserve these traces. If the remembrance of me were destined to die with me rather than compromise anyone, I would, without a murmur, endure an unjust and momentary ignominy. But since my name is destined to live, it is incumbent upon me to endeavour to hand down with it the remembrance of the unfortunate man who bore it, such as he really was, not such as his unjust enemies incessantly endeavour to represent him. Book 9, 1756. I was so impatient to take up my abode in the Hermitage that I could not wait for the return of fine weather, and as soon as my new home was ready, I hastened to betake myself thither, amidst the loud ridicule of the Holbachian clique, who openly predicted that I should not be able to endure 3 months' solitude, and that they would soon see me returning to confess my failure and live in Paris as they did. I myself, who had been for 15 years out of my element, and now saw that I was on the point of returning to it, took no notice of their raillery. Ever since I had been thrown into the world against my will, I had not ceased to regret my dear Chalmette, and the blissful life which I had led there. I felt that I was born for the country and retirement. It was impossible for me to live happily anywhere else. At Venice, amidst the bustle of public business, in the position of a kind of diplomatic representative, in my proud hopes and schemes of promotion. At Paris, in the whirl of high society, in the sensual enjoyment of suppers, in the brilliant spectacles of the theatre, in the cloud of vain glory which surrounded me, the recollection of my groves, brooks, and solitary walks was ever present to distract and sadden me, to draw from me sighs of longing and regret. All the toil to which I had been able to subject myself, all the ambitious schemes which, by fits and starts, had roused my zeal, had no other end in view but that of one day enjoying the happy country ease, to which at that moment I flattered myself I had attained, without having acquired the respectable independence which I considered could alone lead me to it. I considered that, owing to my peculiar position, I was able to dispense with it, and to reach the same end by quite a different road. I had no income whatever, but I had a name. I possessed ability. I was temperate, and had freed myself from the most expensive wants, which are satisfied in obedience to public opinion. Besides, Although indolent, I could work hard when I chose, and my indolence was not so much that of a confirmed idler as of an independent person who only cares to work when he is in the humour for it. My copying was neither a brilliant nor a lucrative employment, but it was certain. The world approved of my courage in having chosen it. I could always feel sure of work, and, if I worked hard, of earning sufficient to live upon. 2,000 francs, the remains of the profits of the Devin du Village and my other writings, was a sufficient capital to keep me from being pushed for money for some time, and several works which I had in hand promised me, without being obliged to draw upon the booksellers, a sufficient addition to my funds to enable me to work comfortably, without overexerting myself, and even to employ to advantage the leisure of my walks. My little household, consisting of 3 people, who were all usefully employed, was not very expensive to keep up. In short, my resources, which corresponded to my wants and desires, bade fair to promise me lasting happiness in the life which my inclination had chosen for me. I might have thrown myself entirely into the most lucrative path, and instead of lowering my pen to copying, I might have devoted it entirely to writings, which, in the flight which I had taken, and which I felt myself capable